everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on the world's water wells drying up when we come back. Well, to begin with, in David W. Kirkpatrick's Senior Education Fellow, a member of the U.S. Freedom Foundation, wrote a piece on school funding, an invalid excuse and a futile hope. He said last week's Friday the 13th was not a good day for the public school establishment, because that evening on ABC TV, John Stossel presented a program entitled Stupid in America, How Lack of Choice Cheats Our Kids Out of a Good Education. Well, in defense of what Stossel admitted is the program's nasty title, he said some nasty things are going on in the America or the American public school system, and it's about time that we faced up to it. His unflattering look at the nation's public schools is but the latest in a very long list of studies and critiques, few if any of which had any real appreciable effect. The ability of the school system's adherents to resist change is vastly underestimated. There are many examples, but perhaps the most significant is the constant harping on the need for more money, despite extensive and conclusive evidence to the contrary. Even much of the general public accepts that there is a shortage of money in the public school system as gospel. Many public educators are so convinced of this that they probably could pass a lie detector test. But believing that the earth is flat doesn't make it true. Now, a high, or perhaps more accurately, a low point came as John Stossel talked to some educators about funding public schools, and he noted that the district that they were in is now spending $10,000 per pupil per year. The educators, surprise, surprise, argued that this is not enough. $10,000 a year per pupil per year is not enough. So Stossel inquired. He said, well, then how much would be sufficient? $12,000? $15,000? How much money would you educators consider enough to educate children in public school and to do an adequate job? So one woman said $20,000 or $30,000 or as much as they could get. I guess that would mean $50,000, $100,000, $200,000, $500,000, $1 million, or $10 million a year per student. Obviously, this woman was totally unaware of both the facts and the implications of what it was that she was saying. First of all, this public school supporter implies that she clearly has no idea of how much money that it would take and was just throwing out some numbers. The second point is that she has given no thought as to how much money that it would take to spend $30,000 per student per year. Or she has not considered the impossibility of it ever happening. $30,000 a year for each of the nation's 50 million public school students would cost the nation $1.5 trillion. That would be three times the current national annual expenditures for the entire public school system nationwide. $1.5 trillion. We're now spending about a half a trillion dollars, $500 billion a year, on public education. Third point is that to that amount would really be required, which will never happen in today's dollars, is a confession of failure and of the total futility of trying to make the current system work. Fourth, and most importantly, this woman's statement is an unintended admission on her part that, like most public educators, she has absolutely no knowledge of the history or current status of the system that she so stoutly defends. Not only are there public school districts that are now spending $20,000 and yes, even $30,000 a year per student, there are those that spend far more than that. There are school districts in the United States of America that spend as much as $45,000 per student per year. And despite such high spending, every one of them still get mediocre results. One district that spends in excess of $45,000 a year per student exceeds conditions far in excess of what others argue for or even dream about. It has one teacher for every four students. That is, 10 teachers for every 40 students. Its class sizes range from a minimum of 5 students to a maximum of 12. And yet, in what is obviously a very wealthy district, its students still score well below average on some of the state tests. Now, there are more than 14,000 school districts in the United States. Thus, there are 14,000 plus funding and spending systems in existence. Where is the district that says it has enough money? Have you ever heard of one? Where is this magical district out of 14,000 somewhere in the nation that says we have all the money that we need and we are scoring in a range that makes us well above the national average? Where is the one, especially but not exclusively, among the hundreds of urban districts that gets satisfactory results, let alone exemplary results, or even above average results? Now, what will it take to get the taxpaying public to realize that even the districts that are financially flush are educationally bankrupt? As the headline of a column Al Knight wrote in the Denver Post more than 12 years ago, he proclaimed, quote, "If money is the solution, that's the problem." That was and still is correct. If money really is the solution, and there will never be enough of it, then the situation is indeed hopeless. And the sooner that it is recognized, we will begin to develop approaches that show promise of actually working, particularly those incorporating individual choices for teachers, individual choices for students and parents. And as Stossel notes, is true in other nations, the better. If it were not for the school system's monopoly on the education of the poor, the schools would have gone bankrupt long, long ago. I want to point out that in the cost of educating children here in the United States, the number just a couple of years ago was $7,000 a year per student. Now it's up to $10,000 a year per student. But the parochial school system hasn't changed. It still takes about $2,500, or about 25% of the amount of money that it takes to educate a child in a parochial school. So you can send your kid to the local Catholic school for about $2,500 a year. And your child will score at the 80th percentile if you do that. If you spend 25% of the national average, your kid will come out 60% academically superior to a public school child. And if you educate your child at home, it'll cost you $546. That's the last number I have. Let's round it off to $1,000. If you spend $1,000 a year educating a child in a home school, he'll score at the 86th percentile. In public school, where we're spending an average of $10,000 per child, they score on average at the 50th percentile. And if it's in an inner city public school, where we're spending $14,000 per child, $14,000, inner city public schools, they'll score at the 28th percentile. Now, the evidence is very plain. The more money you spend on public education, the dumber your child will become. And if that's what you want, public school is certainly the answer. Now, again, this comes from Kirkpatrick. You can probably get a copy of it if you'd like. In fact, I think you could probably subscribe. We do here. This is a weekly publication that comes out from David W. Kirkpatrick. It's a two-page newsletter, weekly, free of charge. And I think if you went to www.freedomfoundation.us, I think you'll get it. www.freedomfoundation.us. There may be a charge for it, I don't know. Why don't you go to him and ask? This guy's really pretty good. He puts out a paper once a week, and he always has a good topic, and this one happened to be one of those outstanding topics. Now, I mentioned to you when we started tonight's program, we'd be talking about the world's water wells are drying up. I happened to be musing a little bit the other day about Matthew chapter 24, so let me tell you what my musings were. There are five major problems that face the world. Diseases like this new avian flu, or AIDS, or Ebola, or 44 other diseases. Peak oil. We've reached peak oil. If not, we're very close to it. Nuclear war. Nuclear war has been a threat to humanity since World War II. Famine is the specter that we see stalking the world. 15,000 people a day were dying 30 years ago. Today it's 20,000 people a day. And there's no real major famines going on in the world. You know, not like Ethiopia or Somalia or some other country that's starving to death. And then to add to that, we have a new problem here called water depletion. Water depletion. I came face to face with this year when I had to drill a new well. My well went dry. I thought I knew just about as much about underground water supplies as anybody else. After all, I'd been to public school, been educated. State told me that the water, the aquifer is recharged from rainwater. And I figured that, well, that's pretty natural and normal. There's a natural system in place here, then under the ground there's a vast store of water that we call an aquifer. And we bore a hole through the earth's crust down to the aquifer and we pump the water out. And of course the question arises, well, where did that water come from? Well, it comes from the rainwater. It comes from rivers and various other water sources that when it rains, it seeps back down into the ground and that purifies the water. And that's why the groundwater is always so clean. A clean, wholesome source of fresh water right under your feet. Well, my well went dry, so I called Newton and I said, hey, Al, could you come out here and drill me a new well? And he came out and he drilled a new well. The old well was at 300 feet. And we had plenty of water since 1968 when they drilled it. Had plenty of water here. We weren't complaining. And then I noticed that my neighbors around me, first of all, it was Dale Smith. He had to drill a well down to 425 feet here about 10 or 15 years ago. And then I noticed that Don Uchman and everybody else around me was drilling wells, you know, and for some reason our well at 300 feet seemed to be doing all right. All of a sudden, you know, one day we found out that our well was pumping dry. You'd turn the water on, and half an hour, you know, it'd pump dry, and you'd have to shut it off and let the groundwater recharge in the well. And pretty soon it was 20 minutes, and then 15 minutes, and pretty soon it got down to the point where you couldn't get enough water out of that thing to service. You couldn't water the cows, couldn't take a shower, couldn't function. So I said, well, I guess we got to drill a new well. So Newton came out and he said, well, we need to go down to 500 feet. Now, it just so happens that in 1907, they came out here and they dug a water well down in the valley. It's 40 feet deep. May Heard, 1924, had old Joe dig a hand-dug well. It's 35 feet up here, not a quarter of a mile from where my well is located, and they had plenty of water in 1907, and they only went down 40 feet. Well, at some point in time, we don't know just exactly when, somebody drilled a 120-foot well out by the old homestead, 120 feet. And evidently they had water, but it's been long dry, 120 feet down. And, of course, when our well was drilled in 1968, they went down to what they called the Ruby Dew Strata, and they got plenty of water. Plenty of water. That was in 1968. But between 1968 and 2005, 300 feet was no longer adequate. You know, that's just where I'm at here locally. So we drilled down to 500 feet. Boy, this is a wonderful well. This well, you know, at 500 feet, recharges at the rate of 52 gallons a minute. Hell, the pump can only pump 28. So it recovers it at double, you know, twice as much water is flowing into it as we can pump out of it. And furthermore, it comes in under pressure, and it's up to 292 feet, I think he measured. So they got the pump set at 468 feet, and the water on top of it, or from the bottom of the well up to the level in the well, is 292 feet. We could round it off to 300. It's got 300 feet of water in it. Isn't that just marvelous? And yet, 30 years from now, that well is going to be dry. 30 years from now, that well will be dry, and we will be drilling down to 1,000 feet next. And then 2,000, and then 3,000 feet. And how do I know that? How do I know that that's going to happen here? Well, because that's what's been happening over the past 100 years, not only here in the United States, but around the world. And as the population of the world has grown in my lifetime from 2 billion people to 6 billion people, they tell us that by about the year 2025 or 30, we're going to be entertaining 6 billion people on this planet. 6 billion. Double today's population and only in the next 30 years. And that's because population is growing geometrically. It grows 1, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32. It's not growing arithmetically at 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Now your wages grow arithmetically, but our debt grows geometrically. And what that means is that it's unsustainable. That if you look into the future and just project into the future the rate at which we are consuming oil, or the rate at which we are using up land, or the rate at which we are drawing our money out of the bank, you can see that over time, you know, it isn't going to happen today, tomorrow, or next week, but over time, that is 5 years, 10 years, or 20 years down the road, it's going to be empty. So a solution needs to be developed now. Now, scientists are very excited about global warming. And they warn us. They tell us that if global warming continues, that it is going to threaten a lot of people's lives. It isn't going to kill everybody on the planet. It isn't going to eliminate life from off the planet. But it's going to make life very difficult, and it is going to eliminate a lot of people from off the planet. So I guess we could put global warming down on our list as being just one more of the many problems that the people on planet Earth and our leaders, our politicians, face in trying to solve these problems. Now, in most cases, problems are solvable long before the drastic event transpires. For instance, I go out in the field and I look at my cows eating grass. And every week I take a look at how much grass they've eaten. And I can look at 30 cows in a field, and I can see the amount of grass that's left in the field, and I can see how fast they're eating it, and I can just mentally project that these cows are going to be out of feed in about 1 week, 2 weeks, or 3 weeks. And then it says to me, I have to make provisions so that I've got a place to move those cows in 1, 2, or 3 weeks to new pastures so that they can continue to eat. I mean, that doesn't take a whole lot of brains. It's not rocket science. And conversely, we have to plan for the future. If you're a man that's 25 or 30 years old, and you know that when you get to be 65, you won't be able to work at nearly the rate that you're able to work today, so you plan for your old age, and you say, well, at some point in time, I'm going to become old and full of years and unable to work anymore, so I had better save some money so that when I get to be 65, I've got enough money, or I've got enough land, or I've got enough wealth that I can take care of myself from 65 to 75, 85, or 95. My old granddad, Snyder, who died in 1946 at age 92, never drew Social Security, never had a pension, never worked for a corporation, and yet somehow or another he took care of himself until the year he died. In fact, he left a pretty sizable inheritance for his children. There was a time here in America when people could actually take care of themselves without Social Security, without a pension program from the corporation. They could create a business. They could save their money. They could build a house. They could own things that were free and clear. They owned property and they could take care of themselves. Today, that's no longer true. If you take a look at the demographics in America, and you take a look at the social structure and the monetary resources, we find that very few Americans are able to take care of themselves. So what's happened? And very few Americans seem to be able to look into the future and to solve a problem. Now, I can see I've got a problem here over the next 30 years, and I'm already pushing 70. But by the time I get to be 97 years old, my well is going to be dry again, and I'm going to have to drill a new one, or I have to be able to look ahead and solve that problem, just like I do with solving the problem with feeding my cows. I got to solve this problem of taking care of my water supply. And then there's the children coming up after me. You know, there are sons and granddaughters and so on, and these people have to be taken care of, or they have to be prepared for it. And so for me to use up their water, for me to use up their land, for me to squander the resources that future generations are going to need for their own livelihoods would be a crime on my part. In fact, in the scripture, God says that a righteous man leaves an inheritance for his children's children. Now that's your grandchildren. You should have an inheritance that's large enough. You should have an estate that is large enough to not only take care of you and your immediate family until you die, you should leave enough to take care of your children to at least get them started, if not to take care of them until they die. And then you should leave an inheritance for your grandchildren, at least to get them started, if not until they die. Now, that's three generations that you need to take care of. That's your generation, your children's generation, and your children's children's generation. There should be something left over for three generations after you finish a day's work. Americans don't do that, and in fact, we don't even think in those terms. And that's because we have Social Security and pension programs. We have welfare and food stamps. And we don't have to take care of ourselves. Like the wild hogs of the Okefenokee, we have now been herded into the big clearing in the center of the swamp. We are now surrounded by fences. And boys and girls, I think the gate has already been closed, at least for practical purposes and for most people. So I thought, well, let's take a look here at this water problem, because you've got a water problem in the United States of America. A big water problem. And I didn't know quite how big or how severe this water problem was. Now, a couple, 3 weeks ago, I did a series here on drought. We've got a big problem with drought. I knew that. And I reported on it. What I didn't know was that that was the tip of the iceberg. The body of the iceberg is in the underground aquifers, and that's a bigger problem than the drought itself. And what it spells out is this, that the world is on a collision course with famine. We, ladies and gentlemen, are on a collision course. Now, we're real concerned about the war in Iraq. Let me tell you, the war in Iraq is a pimple on the elephant's trunk. It doesn't even come up on the radar screen if you want to take a look at the problems that threaten your life. As a truck driver, or as a carpenter, a plumber, an electrician, or an unemployed old bag lady living under a bridge someplace, you've got a bigger problem than the Iraq war. You've got a bigger problem than the economy. In fact, you get a bigger problem with water than you have with nuclear bomb war, or with disease, or with peak oil. So gather around, boys and girls, and listen up, and let me tell you the story of the world's water wells are drying up, and what that water is used for, and why it's going to impact you, wherever you live, around the world. Fortunately now, around the world, there are some people who have plenty of water and are going to have plenty of water into the indefinite future. This does not mean that when you draw the water out in Chicago, that the people in Florida are going to go thirsty. But as populations in Chicago grow, the water supply problem grows. They've got to have more water. And they have to have more water, not just to drink, because that's the pimple on the elephant's trunk. It's the massive quantities of water that it takes to produce food and fiber. That's the Achilles heel. Here in America, about 90% of our water is being used for agriculture, 7% is used for industry, and 3% is used for domestic home supply. So if you take the numbers, boys and girls, you don't have a problem with water coming out of your tap. That's not the problem. Although many municipalities and many mayors would take exception, and we'll see some of the stories that are coming out around the country concerning little towns whose wells are going dry and they're having to spend large amounts of money to secure new water supplies, oftentimes many miles away, and the aquifer beneath their feet has gone dry, just like mine did. And so the solution is, well, we'll just drill deeper wells. And in some cases, the drilling of deeper wells doesn't solve the problem, because below the aquifer, there is no water. I didn't know that. I thought that the aquifer went down forever. You know, maybe to the center of the earth. Well, maybe not quite to the center, but down a long ways. And that's because a lot of places that I've heard of drill 3, 4, 5, 6,000 feet to get water. Can you imagine a well 6,000 feet deep? My God, that's an oil well. When you're drilling down here 6,000, 10,000, 15,000 feet, you know, we're talking about drilling for oil, boys and girls. We're not looking for water. Water is something that we drill 30 feet. I can remember when I was a kid in Yellow River Valley, you could go out there with a sledgehammer with a point and drive it in the ground 30 feet and get water for your house. 30 feet. You could drill a 12-inch casing 30 feet deep anywhere in Eel River Valley and get enough water to run 30 sprinklers with a 30-horsepower pump anywhere in the valley. Now we find that you have to drill a little deeper in the valley. We've used that water up over the years. And we have some big aquifers here in the United States. Big aquifers. And those aquifers are going dry. And the crazy part of it is that a huge percentage of the food and fiber that we produce in the United States, 40%, comes from irrigation. And the aquifers that supply the water are going dry. Boys and girls, that's a problem that isn't going to go away. That's a problem that's going to impact all of us in our lifetimes in the next 10 and 20 years. Stand by. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. And for more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, please go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives, and it can be accessed through the website. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, economics, history, health, news, and current events 7 days a week. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Now, to order yours, just call the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that those authors or publications that we endorse or recommend are going to reciprocate. Most of these authors and publications cited on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not necessarily 100% endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or call direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we are talking about the world's water wells are drying up. And I gave you the introduction from the Executive Intelligence Review. And we'll start our program off on a report from www.larouche.com. That's spelled LAROUCHEPUB.com. If you'd like a copy of this portion of the report, it comes from the Executive Intelligence Review. It is a chapter from a book. This book chapter appears in the March 10th, 2006 issue of the Executive Intelligence Review. It's The World's Water Wells Are Drying Up by Professor Lance Endersbe, spelled E-N-D-E-R-S-B-E-E-A-O. I don't have any idea what an A-O is, but that's him. He's Emeritus Professor Lance Endersbe, is former Dean of Engineering and former Pro Vice Chancellor of Melbourne, Australia's Monash University and World Authority on Rock Behavior and Tunneling. He reviews the disastrous state of world groundwater and shows why it is not replenished by rainfall, contrary to the textbook models. Now, around the world, groundwater from deep wells is the main source of drinking water for more than 3 billion people. I'm going to pause there. Let me put in a couple of 3 exclamation points, and let me underline that number. Boys and girls, there are 6 billion people in the world, 3 billion, one-half, 50%. That's you and me, 3 billion people, get their water out of the ground. In addition, a large proportion of the food supply in many poor countries is based on irrigation from these wells. However, almost all of the world's wells have falling water levels and declining yield, and already many have run dry. These deep water wells cannot be replenished from rainfall. Let me underline that. These deep water wells cannot be replenished from rainfall. Now, contrary to what you and I have always been taught and what we have believed, we thought that, and this is my model, I'm going to interject this here, I thought that all of these aquifers were recharged by the rainfall and by rivers and water flow. In fact, when I went to school, in ag school, because of course they were teaching us that we needed to irrigate. See, there was a time when agriculture operated with rain in due season, predicated upon land Sabbaths and jubilees to keep the soil moisture in the ground. Well, after we abandoned land Sabbaths and jubilees, we used up the organic material in the ground. The ground won't hold the moisture, so we went to irrigation to supply that moisture. Now, as a result of that, we're now on the horns of a dilemma. We are now dependent upon this irrigation water for about 40% of the world's crops. And as the world's population continues to grow, the water table in the aquifers is going down. And some aquifers are, in fact, recharged by rainwater and rivers, but many are not. They're a once-in-a-lifetime phenomenon like an oil pool, and once you have sucked the water out of them, that's it. It's gone. Now, the problem is, it's a vast reserve, and you become dependent upon it like oil, and then one day it runs out. And here's all of this infrastructure on top of the ground. Here's where all of your cattle feeder yards are. Here's where all of your fields are located that you're growing your corn and your wheat out of. And all of a sudden, the water is going to go dry. It's already happening. So we already know what the results are in those areas where it has already happened, past tense. But we're on a precipice now that there will be a breakdown in the waters, in the aquifers, water, useful water that we can get out of it in the next 20 years. That's the shocker. So not only have we reached peak oil, we have also reached peak water. Peak water. It is now declining. There is less water available to us today than there was 10 years ago, and there's going to be less water available to us 10 years from now than there is today. It's kind of like this global warming trend, you know. They say, well, everybody's agreed that yes, indeed, the world is warming up. I guess we'd have to admit that because about, I don't know, 10 or 20% of the polar ice cap, that's the North Pole ice cap, has now melted, past tense. It's already melted. It's gone. And down in Antarctica, down at the South Pole down there, it's retreating. It's melting down there also. So global warming is a problem. And, you know, there's a lot of debate about, you know, well, what's going to happen next. And peak oil is upon us. And whether it's political or physical is irrelevant. When you go to the gas station and there's no gas, I mean, it's what the hell difference does it make whether it's politically induced or it's physically induced? We've reached peak oil. I mean, you're not going out in your backyard and drill an oil well. 50 years ago, anybody could go out in his backyard and drill an oil well. today you can't. You're restricted, you know, you are legally barred from doing that. I mean, don't you go out there and start digging a hole in your backyard now. In fact, in many places, you can't even go out in your backyard and drill a well. I discovered this when we drilled our well here. You know, so we don't drill wells very often, so we don't know much about them until you actually call the well driller. And now you have to have a license and a permit to drill this well, at least the well driller does. And then the well has to be recorded with the state. How do you like that? There's Big Brother. He's coming into the game. And pretty soon they're going to put a meter on my well out here. It's coming. Just get ready for it. They're already doing this in many places around the world, such as Mexico City, which has an acute water shortage. So all of you people out there that are drawing your water out of the ground, get used to the idea that at some point in time, this property right is going to be taken away from you, and a meter is going to be placed on your well, and you are going to pay the state to draw the water out of the ground under your own land. Now, that's a wild new concept. And I'm not sure that it isn't necessary. I'm just a reporter now. Don't get mad at me now for telling you this bad news. But it gets worse than that. It's going to affect you whether you live in New York City and you get your water from a totally different source, or you live out in western Kansas where you depend on the Oglala aquifer for the water in your town and your drinking water and to irrigate your crops, which is where you make your livelihood. And once that water is shut off, boys and girls, you're going to lose your livelihood, lose the water in your tap. And it's already happened in many locations. 6% of the locations in the Oglala aquifer are now dry. I mean, it's a big, big piece of real estate, and there's a lot of water in there. And there's still a lot of water in there. But it's going dry. And everybody is going to feel the pinch, because 40% of the food that we produce in the United States comes from that aquifer, comes from the irrigation. That's why I said you're going to be affected in San Francisco, Seattle, Philadelphia, and Portland, Maine. And that includes you people in Miami, Dallas, and Austin. We're all going to be affected by it, whether we like it or not. So I thought I might give you a report, because in Matthew chapter 24, there is a report written about 2,000 years ago that foretold this problem, and that there was coming a point in time in the experience of humanity when, if God himself doesn't intervene in the world's events, the world's history, no flesh would be saved alive on the planet. That's why I mentioned to you that we've got some big problems over here, in that we are now facing not just water depletion that I'm talking about now, but we still have disease, peak oil, nuclear war, and famine, which are the four horsemen of the apocalypse, which is being exacerbated now by a problem that we all gave God the finger over, and that was over this thing of rain in due season. If you practice the law of God, he'll give you rain in due season. You won't need to drill a hole in the ground. We didn't practice the law, so we didn't get rain in due season, and so we had drought. And so to solve the drought problem, some guy back in 1911, we don't know who it was now exactly, but it started in 1911, hand-dug well into the Oglala aquifer here in the Midwest of the United States, and started irrigating. Hand dug well, started irrigating. And from that point on, we have now drilled millions of these wells. These center pivots are everywhere. We're sucking water out at the rate of, and get this, get this, it takes 1,000 tons of water to produce, I think it's 1 ton of wheat. You get that? 1,000 tons of water. Now, water's pretty heavy stuff. We all know that. I worked out the numbers here. When we get to it, it'll kind of boggle your mind to produce a ton of wheat. In fact, it is cheaper today for the Chinese to buy wheat on the world market than it is to produce it out of their own water reserves. That's a fact. It's now cheaper to buy wheat on the world market and use up somebody else's 1,000 tons of water than for the Chinese to use up their own 1,000 tons of water to produce the wheat in China. Now that's another factor or fact that comes out here in the report. Now notice that these deep water wells cannot be replenished from rainfall, and the source of the groundwater that supports these 3 billion people lies in the interior of the earth. There is a continuing release of water from the interior towards the surface of the earth, and we see that in the steam of volcanoes and the water gushing from the deep ocean vents. Over geological time, some of this rising water has been trapped in the path towards the surface of the earth, and it has accumulated as underground reservoirs of water, just like oil pools. Now, there are resources of groundwater underlying most of the flatlands of the world. And from early times, men have dug wells by hand and then lifted water in buckets for their needs. Many civilizations were established where groundwater was available at oases or in shallow wells. The ancient Romans built aqueducts to bring springs of groundwater to their many cities around the shores of the Mediterranean Sea. Vitruvius, a Roman engineer and architect, describes in his book, written in the 1st century BC, the methods that the Romans used to find and to test underground sources of water, and he tells of the adverse properties of some spring waters. There are cautionary tales about a little well at Susa, the capital of Persia, where those who drink of the water lose their teeth. And there is a well reported in the Alps, where those who drink the water immediately fall lifeless. There are also wells with healing properties, such as the acid springs in Campania, that have the power to break up stones in the bladder. Vitruvius advises on the tests for good water. He said, the first test of water is to look at the physique of the people who dwell in the vicinity and who drink it. Today in the United States, groundwater provides drinking water for one half of the entire population. Did you get that, boys and girls? Let's underline that one. One half of the people in the United States get their water from groundwater. That's just in line with one half of the people around the world get their water out of the ground. The same applies in much of Europe, India, China, and many other countries. The pattern of dependence on groundwater that had continued for centuries began to change about 1950. The population of the world was continuing to increase. There was growth of cities and expansion of city water supplies based on the use of groundwater. And in rural areas, there was the introduction of mechanical pumps and commercial agriculture based on this groundwater. As a consequence, there was a simultaneous and rapid growth in the use of groundwater all around the world, in countries like India and China, in North Africa, and in the Middle East. The use of shallow, hand-dug wells and hand-lifting of water was replaced by drilled bores and mechanical pumps. And the use of fertilizers enabled a very great increase in agricultural yield. But that required much more water. And there was a vast increase in the areas under irrigation from this groundwater. There was a rush to exploit the limited groundwater resources. The groundwater was freely available at the cost of a bore and a pump. There was a competition to use more and more groundwater. Water tables dropped, and farmers drilled deeper bores, and they installed more powerful pumps. And almost simultaneously all around the world, the wells began to run dry. And governments were totally unable to control the extraction of groundwater or to protect the resource. Most governments did not know where the wells were located or the depth of these wells. Governments did not record water levels, but were certainly informed when farmers complained that their wells were running dry. Farmers, governments, and their professional advisors had all believed that the wells would flow forever. The groundwater rush was like a gold rush. It was a great, uncontrolled bonanza. The International Water Management Institute has estimated that the total global withdrawal of groundwater is now about 1,000 cubic kilometers each year. But it is quite unsustainable. This great global rush to exploit available groundwater resources in our time is a one-off extraction of a limited natural resource. I'm going to put a bracket around that paragraph and point out to you that 1,000 cubic kilometers. Now, for you in the English-speaking world, a kilometer is a little over a half a mile. I believe it's about 6/10 of a mile. So in round numbers, if we're using 1,000 cubic kilometers, then we're using about 60% of that, or about 600 cubic miles of water a year that we're drawing out of the earth, drawing out of the ground. That's a bunch. Let me give you a little perspective. If you take all of the rainfall, all the snowfall, all of the precipitation that falls on planet Earth in a year, it amounts to about 186,000 cubic miles of water. And that feeds the Amazon and the Nile River and all the rest of the rivers of the world and all the lakes and so on. That's a bunch of water. The Colorado River is so intensively used, as I reported in my report on drought, that it doesn't even reach the mouth of the river. I was amazed when I read that. They have to let a certain amount of it out, you know, so that it does reach Mexico. I mean, if we wanted to, we could use it all and then some. We have to leave a little in there for the Mexicans. But the thing, for practical purposes, doesn't even run water out into the mouth. The Nile River is a trickle by the time it gets to the Mediterranean. And the Nile River is going to be totally consumed over the next 20 years. Totally consumed by three nations. That is Sudan, Egypt, and one other country. Who's next to it? I forgot now, Somalia or somebody. Three countries. Can you believe that? Listen, the Yellow and Yangtze rivers in China, for 200 days a year, the Yangtze River does not run to the sea. They're using it all. In Russia, the Aral Sea is drying up because they are using all of the water that comes down the rivers that flow into the Aral Sea. They're taking all the water out of it and irrigating with it right now. And the Aral Sea is drying up. There's coming a point in time when the Aral Sea is just going to be a vast desert. Now, I was shocked when I saw these numbers myself, but you know what that spells? Disaster is looming on the horizon. Disaster. And of course, that sounds like Chicken Little, and people get real excited and they say, well, I'm going to listen to this guy. He's some kind of a doomsday prophet over here. And so we don't like to listen to, we don't like to think about hard sayings that are hard to be understood. You know, the average Joe Sixpack, he didn't want to hear this. I want to hear it, and many of you want to hear it, because we need to take evasive action. If you want to be one of the survivors instead of one of the victims, you know, you've got to take some kind of action to alleviate the problem. If you're living in an area where your groundwater supply is drying up, you might want to consider moving. Never occurred to you? Well, it's either that or one day you run out of water like I did here, you know. As old Ben Franklin said, you know, you don't know the value of water until the well runs dry. Now, wells have been running dry, you know, forever. You know, you drill a well and wells run dry. And I didn't think too much about it. When my well went dry, I thought, well, I'm going to drill another well. I don't like the prospect of it. But then I started asking the question, well, why does the well go dry? Well, it's because the water table is dropping. Well, why is that? Well, because more and more people are taking more water out of the ground. More and more people are taking more and more water out of the ground. So if you get 6 billion people in the world today, and the population over the next 25 years is going to double to 12 billion, we're going to take at least twice as much water out of the ground. Between 1950 and 2000, we increased our water consumption by threefold. We didn't take out twice as much water when the population doubled from 3 to 6 billion. We took out three times as much water. So while population doubled, we took out 150% more water in the use. And that's because it takes more water to grow more crops. That's the Achilles heel. It's not drinking water that we're running short of, boys and girls. It's water to irrigate the crops. It's the specter of famine that's coming upon us. That's why I've always told my students, you need a 4-year supply of food on hand at all times. I can't think of a better business to be in than food and famine. Now, there's a group of people on planet Earth called the Mormons, the only people that I know of, that spend their time, or have spent any time, stockpiling food. It's part of their church doctrine and religious practice to be prepared. And so they do that. Hey, listen, let me give you a reminder, and then we'll take this up right here. Let me draw an arrow right there. And tell you a little story here to pay the taxes. Hey, if you're earning $50,000 a year and you pay all of your 14 taxes, you know, you get to keep about 40% of what you create and produce. Your government gets 60%. That's $20,000 for you and $30,000 for the government. Now, I think that's just real special. Now, if you think your share isn't enough, then why don't you work twice as hard and produce twice as much and make $100,000 next year? Then go ahead and pay your same 14 taxes just like you did this year, and you're going to net 24%, and the government's going to net 76%. Well, why don't you call and order my free General Law CD package, and let me tell you how to deal with that kind of crime. It's 4 hours of entertaining information, and it answers many of your legal questions about taxes and why it is that you're paying so much and receiving so little. If you'd like to order that free General Law CD package, just call direct and order yours today. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Or you can go to our website. It's georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine and send us an email request for that free General Law CD package. Remember, georgegordon.org. Or call direct 417-273-4967. And keep in mind that the Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard around the world 7 days a week, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the internet by title and date for your listening convenience. Time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Well, I guess I got one more minute here. It's 58:53. I got a little bit more time here. A little bit more time than I'd thought we had. One more minute. So let me remind you about the Ogla Aquifer that we are talking about here in tomorrow night's program. I'm going to show you the size of the aquifer and the Kerr Center. The Kerr Center has actually done a very extensive analysis of the aquifer. It's the biggest aquifer in the world. Biggest aquifer in the world. 6% of it is now dry. And that's our aquifer here in the United States. And this aquifer is going dry at the rate of 6% a year. 6% is already used up, and it's going dry at 6% a year. All right, our time's up. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, and good night, friends.